listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
And good evening, and welcome to the show, History and You, the show where history matters because you decide what history becomes. Remember that everything here has a history. We discuss it here, we argue it here, we shape it, we give it a new focus for you and only you to think about. I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts and insights, please do so by calling 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Call in and tell me your view on the issue tonight. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at the latalkradio.com. website and look for History and You. Also, please visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube accounts on the website as a follow-up to each program. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at Avcom, where traveling safe always matters, and where safe travel is a top priority and guaranteed. This evening's topic, a very pertinent one, a very relevant one, a topic that all of us have an issue about, all of us have something to talk about, something to do about, something to rectify, something always to improve upon, and that is debt, perceiving debt. How do people perceive the idea of debt? Money is one of the strongest social relations out there, and when it becomes scarce, we value it so much more. Gold is a good example of this. This is the reason for its value. But look at the pattern of our human nature for a moment and check out the things we pursue the most, such as those resources in short supply or items that are less available to us. But we do decide to ignore other resources that are plentiful and all around us. What can this pattern suggest about our attitude and our psychology regarding those things we prioritize and about those things we fantasize with? We all want money, more money, because we know our living standards depends on the money we make. This is the attitude that drives us. This is also the psychology that justifies our motives for money and more of it. But when we don't have the money that makes us feel competitive and respected as a social status, or even if we cannot make ends meet by simply not being able to pay your bills, we still pursue the lure and even the lust for money by fantasizing with it, and that's when we go after the money we don't have, but promise to get. And it's this attempt at money that we quickly mismanage and turns into debt. Debt, whether in the form of high-end mortgages, equity lines of credit, school loans, personal loans, car loans, medical bills, service loans, and of course, the granddaddy of them all, credit card loans. Credit card loans is the lure for a hollow and false wealth. It's a make-believe lifestyle that is never realized and will always deteriorate. Oh, if I can only have that dress. Oh, if I can only have that jean, that trip, the house, the suit, the boat, the car. In short, if I can only reach that higher status in my efforts at trying to be more than what I am or more than what I can afford to be. You might even think to yourself, I'll be in a much better place mentally and feeling better about myself once I get the money I need. And in the meantime, there you are, accumulating more debt. It doesn't work that way. And no matter how many times I tell people, there is out there a fixed mindset that doesn't listen. A mindset that's surrounded and protected by a psychology that warrants or excuses the fictitious or flawed idea that somehow accumulating large debt in a free and democratic society has come to be expected, and that such debt will never set you back financially, at least never enough to seriously deny you all the basic perks that come from living in America. What is it about living in a democratic society anyways that attaches to our living standards like a leech the peskiness of debt? Has being so permissive or remiss about debt become so deeply embedded in our history that we don't even realize how serious it is? To put it plainly, debt can sink us. It can sink us as a family, as a people, as a state, as a nation, and as a federal government in the world contending for power. Economically and politically, with other governments also vying for power. Our national debt today is now well over $16 trillion. And by the end of Obama's second term, it's expected or predicted to reach over $20 trillion. Simply asked, are we spending more money on federal programs than what we're currently taking in as federal revenue? Are we printing more money than needed? Are we nurturing more entitlement programs than necessary? Can we afford to maintain a growing federal bureaucracy that offers more costs in creating programs, which only encourages a labor force to be more dependent on the federal government? And if we don't manage to reconfigure our perspective on limits, availability, and financial responsibility, we will all be diminished the hard way by eventually being left with very little or next to nothing. It's inevitable. Civilizations have ended this way, and the United States, as we and the rest of the world have come to know her, will be no exception to this rule. With me tonight is a gentleman that can perhaps help answer some of these difficult questions that challenge people to a change in lifestyle. But first, let me take a quick moment to pause to remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number here is 323-203-0815, or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I would love to hear from you. Let me also take a moment to mention a quick word about the value of AVCOM. Airline and companies, please, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at AVCOM really do go out of their way to make sure all your destinations are met. What do these folks do? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order. As we know, that's a very, very, very important point, because wherever we go, be it a business trip or on a leisurely family vacation, we all want to know that we're boarding a plane that is safe with all instruments working properly. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why do airlines pay attention to AFCOM? AFCOM is one of the largest third-party automatic test equipment operators in Miami. We provide avionics and component repairs, defect rectification, scheduled maintenance, and overhaul and modifications of avionics. We are also an FAA, EASA, and pending CAAC-approved repair facility, and they have been in business for well over 25 years. That offers folks an awful lot of confidence. They are an approved repair station for DMF, Air Transit, Air Wisconsin, Boeing, Comair, Delta, ExpressJet, Allegiant Airlines, and many more. AFCON operates in 17 automatic test equipment systems and is an approved vendor for 95% of domestic and international carriers. That's another fact that offers an awful lot of confidence. They have a warranty return rate of less than 1%. That's less than 1%. So call these folks. Call them at 305-436-0300. That number again, 305-436-0300. Or you can check them out on the web at www.avcom-avionics.com. That's www.avcom-avionics.com. Okay. With me tonight is a gentleman who earned his PhD in history from Florida International University. His dissertation, An American Political Economy, Industry, Trade, and Finance in the Antebellum Mind, covers the domestic economic discourse in the pre-Civil War years. His research interests include the history of modern economic thought, Jacksonian America, and the political economy of the Cold War. He has written on the history of the notion of corporate social responsibility for the Center of Ethical Business Cultures at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My guest also teaches history at the high school and university level and is currently working on a history project that involves the creation of a student journal for young high school social science enthusiasts who wish to debut their writing skills at an earlier age. Ladies and gentlemen, a fine educator in the field of history and related social science, Dr. Chris Calvo. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Good evening, George. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Sure, my pleasure. Now, Chris, let's discuss the issue of debt here, because that's an issue that I'd like to share with you, given the background that you have, which is nothing less than impressive. The issue of debt surrounds us all every day. We know we have to manage it. We know we have to deal with it. Some people have to learn how to cut back on it or learn to deal with an overweight debt. So in discussing debt, let's begin by simply asking you, what is debt, Chris? And in some way, can you conceptualize debt for us?
Well, put simply, George, debt is that which is created whenever one of two parties involved in a transaction puts off or delays turning over their end of the transaction, but gets something instead immediately in return. So basically, when somebody gets something without having to put up the money or labor or service in return immediately.
So in other words, it's sort of like putting a payment off, putting off what you owe.
Correct. Right.
And I'm sure a lot of people do that all the time.
And there are two, George, forms of debt. There are what we call secured debt, which is when the debtor offers an asset or something as collateral in return for entering that debt. And then there is unsecured debt, when the debtor essentially does not have something concrete to offer the creditor.
Right. And when we're talking about secured debt, we're probably talking about larger items like, for example, mortgages on houses and things like that.
Exactly. Cars and boats.
And unsecured debt is normally the credit card thing.
Exactly. And the new phenomena that American debtors are experiencing, student debt, right? Student loan debt.
Yeah. And it's precisely the student loan debt that's really a little bit scary, because you have the students without necessarily having the income to pay their bills or accumulating debt on credit card balances. And they're going off purchasing all sorts of things, naturally school-related items, as we know, but also other personal items. And it's kind of scary to know that they don't have the income or the finances necessary to cover all their purchases. Chris, there's another question that I wanted to ask you. How do Americans perceive debt? Because that's really the principal aim of tonight's program. How do they approach debt? How do they perceive it? What do they think debt is?
Well, the American relationship to debt, George, has always been rather complex and rather naughty, I suppose.
Yeah, I'd say.
We have always been a highly leveraged society as individuals and as our state and federal governments are concerned.
So are you suggesting then at this moment that the federal government have become enablers as far as encouraging people to accumulate debt?
Well, the federal government itself was born into debt, right? We were conceived a national government in debt when the Constitution was ratified in the late 1780s. One of the first issues that our first Secretary of Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, was confronted with was how to deal with $75 million in debt that the former Confederate government had accumulated, and the debts accumulated by the various state governments.
The idea of debt in relation or in the context that you're presenting it with now has to make sense, because America was born as a debtor nation by default because of all of the debt that it probably accumulated from the Revolutionary War.
Right. And that is one of the fantastic things about debt, and we need to think of debt as being inseparable from credit, right? Debt exists because of credit, and credit for federal governments is actually a fantastic thing, because it allowed, for instance, the American government to come into existence. Without credit, the 13 colonies would have never been able to finance the war for independence against Great Britain.
Right. And you know, that's a really interesting point that you're bringing up, because the debt, even at the national level, it seems to be something unreachable, but it's really not. When you think about debt in the form of debt being a good kind of debt, it allows the opportunity of an entity like the federal government or an individual to prove his worth and saying that he is responsible and reliable in paying off what he owes, be it at the personal individual level or at a higher level like the federal government.
And those were Alexander Hamilton's sentiments exactly when he presented his report on credit to Congress in the early 1790s. He called credit the invigorating principle, and it was meant to invigorate not only national growth, but it was also intended, falling into debt and being able to make scheduled payments earned America credibility and respectability in the international community. It established this nation as an independent sovereign nation.
Right.
And so credit and debt
in that sense has been and or was tremendously valuable to
so really,
our nation's history.
When you're talking about debt, you're really talking about debt in a way that is almost indispensable. It can be a very valuable tool for a government as well as a person or a business to have a certain amount of debt and use that as a leverage for a future promise to grow more financially.
And George, you are repeating close to what the famed 20th century Austrian American economist Joseph Schumpeter said, that credit is essential to the entrepreneur. Credit is essential to economic growth. Credit is the most fundamental principle, the most fundamental element to national economic growth and individual economic growth.
Right. And remember that you're really talking about credit, but we are making a positive correlation between debt and credit. So in other words, the credit cannot be there unless the debt is there first.
Naturally.
And so at this point, then after clarifying this point, what do you tell people out there? Because this is really the crux of the question. What do you tell people out there who have this overwhelming debt and somehow subliminally, psychologically, they feel that it is not entirely a bad thing to have debt if it leads to credit? So knowing that debt is important in relation to credit and your future financial growth, what do you tell people out there that have a debt problem?
Well, I would say that managed debt is a very positive thing. And Alexander Hamilton made the controversial point that a public debt is a public blessing. A public debt is a public blessing because it establishes a certain process that is fundamental, that is essentially a fundamental economic process that is valuable not only to national sovereigns, but also to individuals. It teaches them responsibility. It teaches them how to manage their personal finances, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. And so obviously, the idea of debt has to be this manageable thing, because if it's not managed, then, of course, like so many other things in life, it quickly gets out of hand. How, Chris, can we advise people as to how they can better manage their debt? What might be some of the things that you might recommend offhand that would enable them to consider, probably for the first time? If not, they've heard it before, but long ago and far away, how they can better manage or gain a better grip or control over their debt?
Well, first, of course, I would recommend that people consult a professional financial advisor, which I am not. But if I was giving friendly advice to someone, I would certainly tell them to pay down their high interest credit cards. I would tell them to manipulate interest rates or refinance into mortgages to take advantage of the historically low interest rates that are offered today.
And they are really low out there now. Yeah.
And, you know, to pay off your credit cards on a month by month basis, right. Those kinds of things.
Right. Right. Now, Chris, let me ask you something else that I think is very pertinent at this point. As a historian, obviously a very qualified one at that, my question to you is based on a positive correlation. Is there a positive correlation between debt and a free and democratic society?
Well, I think in order to establish that correlation, George, we have to kind of think deeply about the nature of democratic societies in the modern age and the nature of free market economies in the modern age. Now, if you are someone who agrees with, say, Milton Friedman or even David Hume, you would agree that democratic societies are always going to flow from free market economies. economies, or that free market institutions are the father of democratic political systems. And if you are like everyone else, you perhaps associate free market institutions with financial capitalism. And an essential element of financial capitalism is, of course, credit and debt. So if we're going to kind of paint that narrative, then yes, we can say that debt and credit are fundamental to financial capitalism. Capitalism is fundamental to democratic societies.
Now, if I were to ask a slightly different question here, such as, is there any kind of a correlation, not necessarily a positive one, but any kind of a correlation between debt and a capitalist society, how different would it be to the first question, which addressed a positive correlation between debt and a free and democratic society?
Well, now the thinking on this can be kind of complex, depending on what school of thought you agree with. Now, there is, and there has been for the last 250, 300 years, a school of thought out there that says financial institutions, banks, and debt and credit are in stark contradiction, undermine democratic free societies.
Oh, okay.
Because what social commentators for, say, the last 300 years have noted is that there's something about financial capitalism. There's something about financial institutions that have the tendency of undermining democratic republics. Because the thinking is out there by some social commentators who have commented on this issue over the past 300 years or so, that there is something about finance that does not allow financial institutions to exist without the support of government, and that the relationships between financial institutions and government are always too close for democratic-loving, republican-loving people.
So, in simpler terms, what does that suggest?
Well, we see it, say, we see an obvious example of this, George, with the 2008 financial crisis and the response to it, the enormous TARP bailout fund that was shoved down the throats of Americans, some $800 billion. Drawn up by government officials with very, very close ties to finance. It's hard not to see that relationship as being corrupt. And so, as a conclusion, some people might say, we can say that financial institutions are inherently bad for democracy. And that line of thought, that argument can be traced in the Anglo-American tradition stretching back to the late 17th century.
Do you agree with that?
Do I agree with that? George, I think historically it is difficult not to see perhaps a corrupt relationship develop between financial institutions and government.
So, in other words, to give this a roundabout view, what you are saying is that free and democratic societies try to make their views preponderantly based on their social interests in relation to social programs that they want to get out there. However, the capitalist aspect to democratic societies, with the driving interest of their finances, sometimes runs contrary to what the free market can actually offer.
Well, what I am saying, George, is that there has existed in literature in Anglo-American history for the last, for over 300 years now. There has been a very strong strain in the Anglo-American tradition that says financial institutions destroy Republican political institutions, that there is something about the relationship between financial institutions and Republican institutions where the result is almost always that the financial institutions corrupt Republican, Democratic, political institutions.
Let's get back to the issue of debt here, because debt here always plays a central role within this relationship that you're describing to be naturally contrary toward each other.
Let me make one more point on that, George, just to be clear. The individuals who have made that argument over the last 300 years, most of the time, almost all of the time, the individuals who have made that argument are not what we would call radical left-wingers, are not involved in some kind of socialist or communist conspiracy. No, they are oftentimes celebrated as, well, the finest Republican thinkers that the Anglo-American tradition has created. Men like Gordon and Trenchard, Harrington, Bolingbroke, Jefferson, Taylor, etc.
And
these are liberals. These are liberals who celebrate free trade, celebrate free market institutions.
Yeah, but classical liberalism is not like neoliberalism. Let's get that clear, because neoliberalism has taken a different twist to what you are talking about as far as the true classics. But let me ask you about debt in relation to the way a person like what one might consider more liberal at the time, Jefferson. How did Jefferson view debt?
Well, Jefferson, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, struggled throughout most of his life with an insurmountable debt that he was unable to pay off. He had kind of lived under this imagination that toward the end of his life, he was going to be able to settle all of his financial difficulties and emancipate his slaves. Of course, that does not happen. His slaves have to be sold at auction in order to cover his debt. He fell into debt as a young man. Back then, credit relations, of course, were very different. During the early 1800s, credit relations were very different from what they are today. But nevertheless, Jefferson fell into heavy arrears as a young man, and he was never able to get out of them.
And of course, he tried to use debt to the best of his advantage, given his circumstances, as far as trying to advance the country with new programs relevant to the times. Do wars matter for debt?
No. If you look at American history, George, you will see that the single most important contributing factor to the accumulation of the federal debt are wars. We see a remarkable spark or a remarkable increase in debt during the Civil War period. Lincoln and the Republican-controlled Congress.
We did a lot also in the South as far as trying to restructure the entire South, and that helped to get rid of some of the debt that was accumulated during the war period.
Yes, but I am talking about during the actual conflict itself. America, the Union, was able to basically secure victory, was able to finance the war in part because it put itself under a tremendous debt burden. Now, World War One, also a significant factor in the American buildup of debt. World War Two, our debt level in 1945 reached over 100%. Of our GDP, the highest level this country has ever seen, a level that we are quickly approaching. And also, it should be noted, in response to the Great Depression and the several recessions that America has been confronted with, we have also fallen into debt.
At this point, let me take a quick break here to remind our callers once again Take another quick pause here to remind our audience, in case you're joining us late, for the participants who wish to call in with your questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or send me an email, please, at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also take a moment to mention a quick word about the value of our friends at AVCOM. Airline execs, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at AVCOM really do go out of their way to make sure that all your destinations are met and are met safely. What do? They make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order. And we all know how important that has to be in relation to wherever we are going, the trips that we take, be it pleasure or business. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why does the industry of commercial airlines use AVCOM? They are a one-stop avionic repair shop. Yeah, one-stop. They specialize in all three manufactured TCAS systems. In addition, we have a TCAS antenna repair program. I bet you didn't know that. A flat rate is the price repair for $1,895. $1,895. No evaluation fee is included, and it is designed so that you can evaluate the cost benefits of repairing versus replacement. They also repair and overhaul high-end avionics in current production for Airbus, Boeing, Douglas, CRJ, and ERJ aircrafts. They have a licensing agreement with a variety of companies, including Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, ACSS, Smiths, and Thales. They offer superior service and the fastest turnaround possible time. They would be pleased if you would just allow them to quote your next avionics repair. So please call these folks at 305-436-0300. The number again is 305-436-0300. Or you can check them out on the web at www.avcom-avionics.com. Okay, Chris, after discussing the issue of debt at the national level, let me see if I can bring it down to the personal level, which deals with the here and now, which deals with the local folks, which deals with you and I, but which also deals with debt. It's still a relevant issue. It hits us every single day. What I wanted to do is discuss some credit card statistics, because credit cards are one of those things that I think people have developed this personal fascination to use. They feel as if it has absolutely no end to it, that they can use it at a moment's whim, and they can charge whatever they can, knowing that they have so many days ahead of them where they don't have to pay a penny, and at the end of the month they have this low minimum payment, and they feel like it's a spending spree ad seculorum ad nauseum, okay, forever and ever and ever. Some of these statistics that I find here, I just want to share some with you. Not all of them. I have a lot here. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of them, but let me just read out a couple of things here that perhaps you may feel welcomed in commenting about. The average credit card debt per household, that's per household, with credit card debt numbering $15,956. That's the average credit card debt per household, okay? Another one here, which I found rather stunning, average number of credit cards held by card holders, 3.5 as of year end. 3.5, I assume they mean 3.5 million. The total U.S. revolving debts, 98% of which is made up of credit card debt, $801 billion, as of December of 2011. The source here is the Federal Reserve's G19 report on consumer credit released in February of 2012. So this is rather current. Total U.S. consumer debt, $205 trillion. That's $205 trillion as of December of 2011. The same source is quoted. What is your impression of some of these numbers, Chris?
Well, this information, George, and your introduction earlier reminded me a lot of the 20th century American economist Thorstein Veblen, who kind of provides the essential explanation for conspicuous consumption and why
conspicuous consumption is huge. Absolutely.
And why middle class Americans, why middle class Westerners, why middle class aspiring upper class Americans in particular spend the way we do and consume the way we do, and the kind of social and historical explanation for that. And it speaks a lot about our cultural values. And Veblen's explanation was that we spend the way we do essentially to show off, to show other people.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that we can indeed spend the way we do. And there's a long logical explanation that Veblen gives, which we won't get into tonight.
All right. Well, let me at this point, because apparently we had a caller, let me repeat the call-in number again, so that folks out there will be well aware of what number to call if they wish to converse with us or ask a question that they are very riveted or curious about. The number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. So please call whenever you have a moment or an interest. Okay.
But George, before we get to the personal, I wanted to get back to the national debt, the $16 trillion in national debt. And I think it's important for Americans to understand that a rather significant percentage of this debt, and when you look at the accumulation of American debt over the last two centuries or so, a lot of it has come in consequence in response to war and also in response to economic downturns. So I think it's important to look at the national debt, not only as it exists today, but as it has existed through history, as a product of defending American sovereignty and defending, or at least, defending America's economic institutions, our free market institutions.
Right. Chris, let me ask you along that same thought. Is it possible that people basically feed off of the example that comes from the national government's handling of the debt?
Oh, I think certainly, George, yes, that we can all agree, I think, that the federal government does not provide a good example for how Americans should handle their personal finances.
Yeah.
But I think we also need to recognize the necessity of the national debt.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because, I mean, that obviously brings into more credit, and there's also the opportunity and the chance to grow financially as well. Let me hit you with a couple of other of these rather stunning statistics here. 84% of student population overall have credit cards. 84%. 84, Chris.
Yeah.
An increase of approximately 11%. Since the fall of 2004. Let me hit you with some others so that we can get sort of like a group idea here. Only 2% of undergraduates had no credit history.
Right. Now, And I don't know exactly what the consequences for college campuses are going to be, since Washington recently created that financial oversight commission. But,
yes.
But it was not unusual for those in our listening audience who attended college during the 1990s, it was not unusual to find credit card companies
right.
selling their product on college campuses
right.
to unknowing freshmen.
Right. Now, getting back to that only 2% of undergraduates having no credit history, that for me says several things. Number one, without credit history, it's going to be that much more difficult for them to move forward without them knowing how to handle their debt. Number two, they're getting into credit cards awfully fast. Mm-hmm. And it makes me mm-hmm. wonder, do they really know how to handle the idea of credit cards? Because that's sort of like holding the devil by the tail, and you don't know when it's going to whip around and really bite you in the behind. Another one here that's bizarre. 76% of undergraduates have credit cards, and the average undergrad has $2,200 in credit card debt. Additionally, they will amass almost $20,000 in student debt.
And
$20,000.
And this would make Thomas Jefferson and other Republicans like Jeffersons turn in their grave to know that so many young men and women are entering their adult life slaves
yes.
to the creditors.
Yes, yes, yes. Absolutely, absolutely. A note here on some demographics. 31% of Hispanics typically pay cash for their purchases. So is it something about Hispanics that they just don't like the idea of debt, or fear in not knowing how to manage it effectively? Okay. On the contrast, over 90% of African-American families earning between $10,000 and $24,999 had credit card debt. Well, I think that explains a little bit more when you consider the poverty level or living conditions for certain families in need, be it African-Americans or any other ethnicity.
No, I would imagine that, you know, for those Americans who are living in poverty, credit card debt and usage of credit card is a necessity of life. They have no other choice.
This one is bizarre. This one states 26% of Americans, or more than 58 million adults, admit to not paying all of their bills on time. Among African Americans, this number is at 51%. And when finances are tight, 59% of people would pay their credit card bills last. A majority, 52%, would pay the mortgage first, and 38% say they would pay utilities before paying other obligations. Well, to a certain extent, that makes sense, because you got to have a house. You got to have utilities. You got to have running water. You got to have your air conditioning. You got to have your lighting. You got to have all these things. But that doesn't mean that you can arbitrarily decide to ignore all of your bills, but only pay some or the ones that you want.
And it also makes sense, as far as I understand it, George, paying your mortgage on time is the most important thing to keeping up your credit score, right? That is the most important bill you can pay.
You know, our time is running out here a little bit, but I do want to get in several other things that I think is important for all of us to hear and all of us to contemplate and all of us to consider. Today, credit cards are responsible for more than $2.5 trillion in transactions.
Incredible.
A year. Is that incredible or what? And are accepted at more than 24 million locations in more than 200 countries and territories. The other one here is that between 1989 and 2006, the nation's total credit card charges increased from about $69 billion, that's billion dollars, to more than $1.8 trillion. And the grandpapa of them all, the last one here, it is estimated that there are 10,000 payment card transactions made every second around the world.
Facilitated, of course, by the internet and all the online shopping that goes on.
Naturally. Okay, we have reached the final part of our show here, where I always make it a point to leave our listeners with something to contemplate, something to consider, something to reflect regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. What does it say about a culture like ours that values debt and credit with equal measures of protection and enthusiasms? A free society whose people have the opportunity to live a comfortable middle-class lifestyle without having the income to sustain it, but having the credit history to survive it, and without having to limit your budget too much, because after all, you can always roll over your debt on a mortgage refinance or a credit card balance transfer, is truly living a life with each foot in both camps. In the United States, the burden of debt survives because it is not meant to be felt, only sniffed at now and then, without having to tie up your underwear in a knot. People here in this country live a life they owe, but feel that they own without feeling owned by the amounts of money they owe. Let me repeat this again, because this is important for you to think about and to consider in relation to the way you regulate your debt, which will determine and be the driving force and ordering principle to how you live your life. People here live a life they owe, but feel that they own without feeling owned by the amounts of money they owe. So when people say, quote, only in America, unquote, it's either a well-thought-out sentiment or propaganda. In any case, Americans have come to depend on their debt for the way they choose to live. And it's in this choice that people have also come to define priorities. Being thrifty now and again is not the order of the day among a majority of folks today, but to go shopping with a credit card, having a 30-day head start, and without needing to pay the full amount by the end of the month, but only a minimum payment, is probably one of the most cherished values among American norms. Why? Why? Do you think that this balance is going to go away somehow, suddenly and magically disappear? Why? And while there's certainly a need for good debt, such as that of a mortgage or even a credit card with a low and manageable balance, debt in excess amounts has become passé and commonplace. The value of a good debt is where one can show banks and other financial institutions that you are a reliable and responsible payee. And this tendency will carry you far, because having a good credit history will facilitate, I repeat, will facilitate greatly your ability to purchase homes, cars, and other investment properties in your future. But you've got to have a sense of limitation as to what you can't have, a sense of budget as to what you can spend, a sense of foreseeability in recognizing the value of building a strong credit history. This is the key. Credit history will always allow you to have and to enjoy an actual better living standard with an enhanced purchasing power on an ongoing basis, instead of having and further accumulating an oversized debt that offers you a fictitious lifestyle that will soon run its course and either downsize you dramatically or simply take you to bankruptcy. Many people live well because they've taken the time and the effort to protect and to build a good credit history while controlling their level of debt. How well do you live? How well do you live? Don't forget to catch me again next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock by visiting our website at latalkradio.com and look for History and You. And also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook and Twitter and soon-to-be YouTube account on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing all of you a very, very pleasant evening. Good night.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.